Welcome to Change Surfer Radio. I'm Dr. J, and for the next half hour, I'll be your guide to a sexy high-tech vision of a radically democratic future. So keep your mind open and your radio tuned to the left. I'm speaking today with Christopher Thomas Scott. Christopher Scott is a biologist, author, and stem cell expert. He's former executive editor of Acumen Journal of Sciences, former assistant vice chancellor at the University of California, and director of research development at Stanford University. He's a frequent guest on NPR, PBS, and Fox, and the author most recently of Stem Cell Now, which examines the scientific, medical, ethical, and political dimensions of stem cell research. First, let's review for the majority of the listening audience, which is not up to speed on all the distinctions in stem cell research. I'm sure they hear the phrase quite often, but there are quite a number of distinctions to be made about this stuff. Let's talk first about what's the difference between embryonic stem cells and adult stem cells.
Embryonic stem cells come from the embryo, hence the name. They are very powerful, potent cells that are taken from the inside of an embryo, whether it's a mammal or a human or some other animal. And once they're put into a dish, they become very long-lived, some say even immortal, and they have the potential of changing into any of the, more than in humans at least, 200 cell types and tissue types in the body. Now, adult stem cells, by contrast, are older developmentally. It's almost a term that's a misnomer. Adult stem cells actually can be found in the fetus or in very early organisms in their development. But they have already progressed down a pathway of change to the point where they have lost most of their power, or a lot of their power, to change into different cell types. So the difference between the two is really in how powerful they are. The embryonic stem cell is the most powerful. It's also the most controversial because it comes from an embryo. An adult stem cell isn't as powerful, and you can find them in adult tissues, in the heart, in other areas in the body, in the blood specifically.
Now, one of the issues that's always puzzled me about this is that with embryonic stem cell therapies, the proposal is you take some of these embryonic stem cells and you stick them in a person's body, and they have the omnipotent ability to transform themselves into the kind of tissue that's needed in that particular area.
Right.
And there seems to be two general ideas about how you might do this. One is that you take a line of these cells and you clone them out, and you just have them in a jar and you can stick them in anybody. And the other is that you take a sick person's cell, and you take out their nucleus and you put it in an egg and you make a clone of that person and then use those stem cells. Now, which am I confused about?
Well, you're not. You've actually described them pretty well. The first technique, you say, putting kind of embryonic stem cells into a dish and storing them for a rainy day and then putting them into people, that's actually a strategy that's already being used, not putting them into people, but rather putting them into petri dishes. The problem with cells that are unrelated to a particular person are that they can be rejected by that person. So they're of a genetically different type. So if those cells, the first type that you described, actually were injected into a person as a therapy without immunosuppression or drugs that would suppress the immune system, those cells would be rejected by the person. Now, the second way of deriving stem cells is the one that has everyone very excited, and that's by using the same technique that created Dolly. But in this case, you're not actually creating a person that supplies cells. You're simply creating a line or a clone, a colony of stem cells that are specifically genetically matched to the person who needs it, whether that person is healthy or sick. And that's the difference between the two.
So for that second line to be successful, and this gets back to this whole debate that we've been having about whether this is in fact cloning, whether it's related to reproductive cloning, that second line would require that you actually create an embryo, create a new being who is genetically similar enough to the person that they would not, that they would be recognized as their own tissue. So it would have to be pretty close.
Right. So I wouldn't say that you're actually creating a being. That's a term that has a lot of different connotations to it. But in terms of embryology, let's just say, what you are doing is creating a human embryo at the four to six day stage, and then you're destroying that embryo to get to the embryonic stem cells inside. And if that embryo is actually created using the nuclear transfer technique, the same cloning technique that made Dolly, then those cells are genetically or pretty close. It's 99% genetically similar to the person whom you took the original cell from.
Now, the critics, both those who oppose reproductive cloning in general and those who oppose embryonic stem cell research, argue that the technique of perfecting this line of research would also perfect the ability to do reproductive cloning, and therefore the two are intrinsically linked, and that, in fact, creating this being, this thing, this embryo, is, in fact, reproductive cloning.
Yes, it's a fair argument, and the way that I try to reason this out in my own head is that an embryo that is created then destroyed to make therapeutically useful line of cells can never become a human. An embryo in a petri dish also can't become human because it needs to be implanted into the womb to go to full term. And once the embryo is destroyed, the embryonic stem cells themselves have lost the potential to become a fully developed being. So the technique itself actually is a pretty wide fork between that and actually creating a being or a live animal out of it. Now, where critics actually have a point is that if a scientist, with a very low moral threshold decided, I can do this nuclear transfer technique, I can grow these embryos the same way that clinicians grow them in IVF clinics, and put that embryo into a woman, that embryo, that new embryo that's been created in the laboratory could, in principle, develop into a human being. And I think that's the reproductive cloning that everybody talks about. And everybody on both sides of this argument, both people who are doing the research in laboratories, doctors, patients, and those on the on the religious right and who feel morally that this is objectionable, all agree. There's unanimous opinion that that is something we ought not to do.
The people on the religious right counterpose to embryonic stem cell research the potential efficacy of adult stem cells.
Right.
And they show, for instance, the fact that we get those out of bone marrow and we use them for leukemia, and so we're already using adult stem cells, and that there are no problems of rejection when you use a person's own stem cells.
Mm-hmm.
So you've been looking at this research, and it's so politicized at this point that if you are an advocate for adult stem cell research, you're assumed to be a pro-lifer, and if you're an advocate for embryologic stem cell research, you're assumed to be a liberal, and you're not supposed to cross those lines. Which one is ahead? Which horse is actually making more progress?
Well, neither of them. And if you talk to any bona fide stem cell biologist, they will tell you straight out that both types of research need to progress in parallel for the real questions to be answered. And there's a good reason for this, and that's that the embryonic stem cell, remember, goes on to make every cell in the body, including the adult stem cells. So one is a progeny of the other, or one you could say is the daughter of the other. So if you simply stop one arm of this research, whether it's adult stem cells or embryonic stem cells, you're basically trying to do the biology and the discoveries with one arm tied behind your back. And so I think the thing to understand is that stem cell research as a field is astonishingly young. The Thompson, James Thompson of Wisconsin, his paper came out in 1998. 9 years later, this research is still very much in its infancy, and it will take probably another 5 or 6 years before the real power of either cell type is understood fully.
I'm Dr. J. This is Chain Surfer Radio. We're speaking today with Christopher Thomas Scott. He's the author of Stem Cell Now, which examines the many different issues involved in human stem cell research. Now, back in the 1990s, the National Science Foundation, National Institutes of Health, began to reconsider its restrictions on whether to fund embryologic research that involved the destructions of embryos. And Vargas, the head of the NSF at the time, I believe, he agreed with the Clinton administration that this kind of research could be funded. And then the Clinton administration's bioethics council said it could be funded. And then when Bush got elected, he backed off on those, stopped funding stem cells research, except for these 56 lines out there, which had already been destroyed. The argument of the scientific community is that Bush's policies to back off on the funding of embryologic stem cell research has somehow destroyed Americans' capacity to do this research, except that now we have $4 billion out there in California, which may actually fund it, and other money coming through other states. But how seriously do you take this argument that the lack of public federal funding for embryologic stem cell research has set the U.S. back vis-a-vis Sweden and Korea and other places?
Well, the data is still coming in on this, so I'll preface my remarks by saying that these are anecdotal sort of things that I've seen in the literature. And at Stanford, we're actually doing some research. A paper will be coming out in Nature Biotechnology that will get at this empirically. But in lieu of that data, here's what I see. I go to the large stem cell meetings, the international stem cell meetings, both here and abroad, and you can kind of get a feeling about who's talking about what, where the groundbreaking results are coming from. And over the last 5 or 6 years, I've seen a very big shift in where the new discoveries are coming from. 6 years ago, 7 years ago, it was clear that America had a predominant position in terms of stem cell research and where the new results were coming from. Now, I feel, and this is my own opinion, that this has shifted dramatically, and the research that we see, the real good results coming from other countries such as South Korea, from Northern Europe, from Australia, from Singapore, I think is an indication, and all of those countries, by the way, permit embryonic stem cell research, is an indication of where that America may be starting to lag in this field. I also see another, I think, a more chilling effect of the policy, and that's that young scientists are choosing other careers. I've been in academia for 20 years or so, and when you have a young graduate student or a postdoctoral fellow who decides to take another career track, what you do is you basically cut out an entire generation of scientists who can pass that information and knowledge and discoveries on to the next generation of young scientists. And when you have that gap, you also have gaps in technology, in the formation of new companies, gaps in the capital markets. So it really has kind of a snowball effect on American competition. Whether that will really be the case, I think, is still too early to tell, but at least those are some of the signs that I see.
Well, the privatization of the research isn't necessarily a problem, right? I mean, there are some biotech companies out there who would be willing to fund this research, and it could still go on in the United States. I don't understand why the private sector hasn't been able to fill the gap that the public sector has stepped out of.
Well, one reason is that the private sector is much, much smaller than the public sector funding. So the NIH, the agency you mentioned a little while ago, they fund $27, $28 billion a year towards biomedical research. Private sector is a much, much smaller number. And those companies that are in stem cell research, they are now 6 or 7 or 8 years old, and the capital markets aren't, in my opinion, very confident, I guess, in this technology because they don't. There's a moral overhang to it, and when there's a risk, a feeling of risk among investors, investors simply don't invest. There's another thing too that happens inside of academic medical centers, and that's that money generates inventions. So, for example, at Stanford or UCSF here in Northern California, on average, you get one invention for every $1 million of funding that comes in. Now, if there's simply no money coming in to fund research, you have no inventions going out. No inventions going out means that they aren't picked up by companies or investors and made into products.
There's another dynamic that's at play here, which has become very clear over the last couple of weeks as the controversy over Huang, the cloning stem cell researcher in South Korea, mm-hmm. His research endeavor has kind of imploded under a series of accusations about unethical behavior in his lab. And some of them may turn out to be untrue, and I have no judgment ahead of time. And certainly there's a well-organized campaign who would like to take advantage of every possible lapse that he's made. But if any of it turns out to be true, one of the things that's clear is that precisely because we didn't have that research going on in the relatively well-regulated American labs, it went on, and it's been going on in Korea and in China, which has a much less well-regulated medical infrastructure, mm-hmm. and that's why we have these kinds of problems.
Yeah, that's a very good point. I think it's important to note that different countries have kind of different regulatory structures and different ethical boundaries too. What feels okay to us in the United States may feel very different in another country, such as South Korea. But that said, it's true. Compared with American regulations for, in the case of the South Koreans' donation of eggs, the South Korean protocols didn't, or at least they don't seem to have followed the rigor that we would follow here in the United States. And that's why the American author on the South Korean papers, Dr. Jerry Shatton of Pittsburgh, severed his tie with the Koreans.
The original question was whether Huang had bought eggs from one of the women that had worked in his lab.
Yes, I think the question was whether he had knowledge that the women actually donated eggs to his experiment. From an ethical point of view, that raises the question of possible coercion when you actually have someone in power in a laboratory, and the South Korean labs are very much in a hierarchy sort of structure. Whether or not the person in power would actually compel or coerce lab members to donate eggs.
Well, this has actually been, you know, I'm a strong progressive lefty kind of guy, mm-hmm. and a strong supporter of stem cell, embryonic stem cell research. There is a minority faction on the left, a feminist in particular, who are opposed to embryonic stem cell research on safety grounds. They argue that even, you know, when you're not getting them from someone who's one of your subordinates, that the number of eggs that need to be acquired for the research, much less for any future therapeutic, widespread therapeutic applications, would make this an unethical procedure. Your book's not primarily about the ethics of it, but what's your position on that? Because of all the kind of complaints, that's the one of the few that I take seriously.
Right. Well, in my book, Stem Cell Now, I actually do touch on this issue, and that's the issue of informed consent. Whether or not women who are donating eggs are fully informed of the risks, it's different being a sperm donor than being an egg donor. An egg donor procedure is invasive by nature. It has chemicals that are given to the woman. It's hyperstimulation of her ovaries. The eggs have to be removed by an instrument, and so it's not a simple matter. And it's really, really important that women who consent to be donors are informed fully of the risks. Now, the risks, by the way, are significant but minor, and that's just mostly in the 1% range or so where women can have serious side effects, including death in very, very rare cases. And I think that one of the problems with the South Korean paper, at least from folks here at Stanford who are looking at this closely, was that the women in the Hwang lab simply weren't informed fully of what the side effects would be. I happen to agree with the statement of advocates for women's health in this particular regard. I think egg donation has to be looked at very closely, and in terms of the moral dimension of this, we have to consider that eggs are really a moral scarce resource, and that we shouldn't just treat them as other tissue or other cells that we have in our bodies. These are the things that really eventually become us, and we have to pay very close attention to how we deal with them.
One of the folks who's weighed in on this controversy is Dr. William Hurlbut, who I think he's a doctor, isn't he? Or is he a theologian?
Yes.
Yeah, he's a doctor. And he's out there in Stanford also. He's on the President's Council on Bioethics and one of the Christian conservative voices on that council, as I understand it. He's been attempting to mediate what he sees as a set of compromises about the science, the ethical nature of the science, by figuring out ways that you could have embryos and have your cake too. His first proposal was that you pull a cell out of an early embryo, let the embryo go on to become a baby, as I understood it, and then use the cell to make a line of stem cells. And his most recent proposal, as I understand it, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, is that you genetically engineer embryonic stem cells so that they could never become babies and that would somehow make it different than actually using embryos. Am I correct on the two proposals that he's made?
I'm not sure you're correct on the first one. I don't think that he proposed taking a cell out of an embryo and creating a baby with it.
If you didn't destroy the embryo, as I understood it, his first proposal not to destroy the embryo, but just to take one cell out and use that cell to make a line of stem cells.
Yes, that's exactly right. And then if the embryo isn't destroyed and it actually recovers from that single cell being taken from it, then that is a morally different kind of equation than actually destroying the embryo itself. So yes, you're right. The second idea was actually, it's called ANT, an abbreviation for altered nuclear transfer. And Dr. Hurlbut suggests that if a gene for development was actually knocked out of that embryo and making it impossible for the embryo to implant into the uterus, that is also a morally more palatable solution than having an embryo that has the potential to become a being. And experimentally, there have been some results about that. At MIT, Rudolf Janisch and his laboratory actually showed that you could knock out this gene, it's called CDX, and that embryos with that gene knocked out couldn't implant into a uterus. I think the criticism of the Hurlbut argument is that it's splitting hairs, and that if you make an embryo in a dish and knock out a gene, it's still, in some cases, especially in some people's minds on the religious right, still something that we shouldn't be doing. There's still kind of a yuck factor attached to it. And I think that's one place where there'll be some pretty strident discussion.
Is the progress on this politics issue going to have to wait for the Bush administration to leave power? I mean, I'm pretty optimistic about that prospect at this point, but of course the Republicans always seem to be better organized than the Democrats on these issues. Mm-hmm. I'm not presuming anything about your politics, but, you know, I've been pretty depressed over the last 5 years, and now I'm beginning to cheer up again. But it's still, there's 3 years until this administration has to face the music, and maybe the Congress will change, but it doesn't seem like it's going to change very fast. And as long as the religious right has this lock on American politics through the Republican Party, it doesn't seem like we're going to get anywhere on this debate.
Yeah, I wouldn't hold your breath. You know, administrations change, and left or right, and for the last 30 years, America has decided against research on embryos and fertilization and reproductive biology. So it isn't just stem cells. This is kind of the latest chapter in a long book of American policy and politics with respect to embryo research. And Clinton, you mentioned, actually reneged on his initial promise or his statement to lift the longstanding congressional ban on embryo research when he got a lot of letters from his constituents on the right, or people that, I should say, American citizens on the right who demanded that this not go forward. So administrations, I don't think that's really where the change is going to come. I think the change, if it does come, will come from citizens, the majority of whom believe that this research should go forward. Two out of every three Americans, in some polls, three out of every four Americans on both sides of the spectrum, both conservatives, even Catholics, evangelicals, Christians, believe in the majority that this should go forward. As soon as that translates into votes, and those votes translate into candidates that are sympathetic to the research, then I think you'll see a change.
My last quick question. I'm a big supporter of transnational laws and regulations and the concept of world law, and recently the UN disappointed me once again by voting for a resolution to call for an end to both embryonic stem cell cloning, as they called it, and reproductive cloning. Mm-hmm. This was a big victory for the Bush administration, which had been pushing for a joint repro and embryonic stem cell cloning ban at an international level. It has absolutely no teeth, but does this represent any kind of growing momentum for an international treaty to prevent these two kinds of research?
No, I think it's just the opposite. I think the UN vote was muddled. The fact that both sides claim victory show that it didn't achieve its objective on either end. The UN debated that issue not once but three times over the course of 2 years. They just simply could not come to a resolution that would make sense in terms of a ban one way or allowing research one way or the other. So I think the UN is kind of a bad example for how this research actually should be legislated or regulated internationally. Now, there are a couple of other efforts that are underway to look at this issue, Jay, and one of them is the International Society of Stem Cell Research announced today that they were going to establish an international guideline for the use of embryonic stem cells based on the National Academy of Sciences report of about 3 months ago. So that's a very good sign. That's an international body that has scientists from all over the world, and ethicists, by the way. And if that group can get their wits about them and get their arms around the ethical issues, and especially ethical issues that vary from country to country, we may see guidelines that are actually usable.
That's good news. I've been speaking with Christopher Thomas Scott. He's a biologist and the author of Stem Cell Now, which examines the ethical and political and scientific issues in human stem cell research. You can find it at your bookstore. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
You've been listening to Change Surfer Radio. Change Surfer Radio is produced at WHUS Stores at the University of Connecticut. If you want to learn more about democratic transhumanism, or you want to share your thoughts with me, Dr. J, you can contact me at jhughes@changesurfer.com. That's jhughes@changesurfer.com. Or you can read my Change Surfing columns at betterhumans.com or check out the collaborative Cyborg Democracy blog I participate in at cyborgdemocracy.net. Or you can read my new book, Citizen Cyborg. For more details about Citizen Cyborg, visit cyborgdemocracy.net. At the Change Surfer website, you can find past and future shows archived in streaming MP3, thanks to the AInfos radio project. So educate, agitate, and organize, and I hope to meet you in a sexy, high-tech, and yet radically democratic future.